a slightly different style than previous weeks. I'm going to start typing in a blank screen, and you're going to laugh at me. If you want to follow along, like if you want to follow along without actually having to like copy everything out, if you're on symmetry, you can, I think, should be able to. Oh, I might have to change my permissions. Sorry. You should be able to grab this file that I'm going to be kind of trying to recreate from that directory. Let me just change my home directory permissions. There. Okay. So I'm going to. So what I'm going to do, and maybe you want to do as well to follow along, is to have two SSH windows open, both connected to Symmetry. It would also work fine to use your laptop. I think we're on a Zoom call right now as well, so I don't know if anybody else is online. Okay, so, and yeah, so basically today I wanted to talk about how to use Python in a way that lets you actually use multiple cores on a machine. Modern machines like the Symmetry nodes have like 40 cores, so it seems a real shame to just like write code that can only use one. now, actually, depending on the kind of work you're doing, sometimes you can use many cores kind of for free because the math libraries usually know how to use multiple cores. For example, if you use NumPy with like the Intel libraries, they know how to use multiple cores. So sometimes you can get it for free, but what I'm going to talk about today is for cases where you can't and you sort of have to do it yourself. And there are a few different ways of doing this, and I'm going to show kind of this, the one that's sort of closest to being built into Python, which is called the multiprocessing module. The touch tone battling, that's interesting. Okay, so I was trying to think of a nice example of what we could do. And I thought, what I decided on was doing Julia sets, because they're sort of fun. And I thought, I need a computation where I'm going to have to do like a lot of small computations in parallel. So we're going to make pictures of like Julia sets, like Mandelbrot kind of sets. Okay, so to start out, I'm just going to write the basic like Julia set code. And so this is going to be like a little bit boring for a while, or at least not like directly relevant to what we're doing. But this is the part where you sort of get to laugh at me trying to live code stuff. okay, so now if you, like me, have recently looked at the Julia set Wikipedia page. I'm going to write, let's see, you can see that okay, right? Yeah. So the Julia sets are basically, they're maps, or at least I think of them as maps from some point in space, and you're given a function, and you iterate the function many times and ask how many steps it takes to leave a circle of a certain radius. So I'm going to do this like this. There's going to be some max radius and some maximum number of steps. And I'm going to a little comment in here just for kicks. So z is going to be a complex number. C is also a complex number. And we're going to return the number of steps it takes to leave.
Justin?
Yeah?
There's someone on Zoom and they can't get audio. Can you ask the voice in the Skype to check whether that is working?
Apparently audio is not going through to Zoom.
No, it should be. It should go through Zoom. Oh, David is working on it.
Okay, cool. Thank you. Okay, so and we're going to iterate the function. Z squared plus c. Okay, so basically what I mean is, I'm gonna go like this. So up to n max steps, let's see, if abs of z is outside the radius, then we're gonna return n. And then otherwise, I need to turn off. Okay, so this, so, right, okay, good. I think that works. I tried it earlier and I'm trying to just remember it off. I didn't actually write it down for myself because I'd like to live dangerously and you get to laugh at me. Now, so for different, C's, you'll get different, like different patterns. So trying to actually remember what the syntax is for creating a complex number. I think it might be that, where you go that plus times something else times I. So I'm just going to try that and we're going to see if Python complains. Name I is not defined, so that's wrong. Is it J?
It is J.
J is not defined.
You can try 1J and you don't know that it is.
Ah, it's times 1J. Yeah, okay, right. Thank you. you can tell that I don't use complex numbers in my work very much. Okay, so that's how we create a complex. And then I'm going to go, so to take some, there's another way to create complex numbers, which is to go complex. So let's just ask how many steps it takes from the origin. So it's, it says 252. So if you start at the origin and iterate this function, it takes you 252 steps before you leave the circle of radius 2. So that's okay, fine, sure. but then the fun thing comes if you can draw out a grid and ask for a bunch of different points, how long does it take to leave that circle? So now we're gonna do this like process of creating a grid, running this function on each one, and then producing it as an image. This is also gonna take a couple minutes. But hopefully we'll find, you'll see some other tricks that are useful along the way. Okay, so how do you make a 2D grid of things? So a couple of different options, of course, since nothing is easy. The one I like comes from NumPy. Eric, did you say it was David in the sky? Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
But there are two other participants.
Okay, cool. Hello online. Can we make it so that my computer doesn't beep when I don't know if that's possible. I can't hit my personal mute button. So I think it's maybe related to the Zoom. Anyway. Okay, so coming from NumPy, there's a one called MeshGrid. And if you give it a set of an array of x values, an array of y values, it'll give you back two arrays that are like two 2D arrays that where the x values increase in one of them and the y values increase in the other one. So let's see. So x vals, let's make that 1, 2, 3, and y vals. 4, 5, 6. And then I'm going to just print that out and see what that looks like. Not sure why that's taking so long. But you can see basically that, like, so that one, bring me the hockey stick. So that's the X values. You see that, like, the it's reproduced the values I gave it, but they're all like increasing along the columns, and then the Y values are increasing along the rows. So it's a nice way to make like a, if you need to make like a 2D grid. So you'll often see it used like this, where you go, where you save those two values into two arrays. So then XX and YY are each going to be 2D arrays, one with increasing X values, the other with increasing Y values. Okay. And instead of 1, 2, 3, I'm going to make this a cover a grid from -1 to 1 with, like, I'll make it 256. Make both of them like this. Okay, so then if I print out their shape, I should, that should be a 256 by 256 array. Okay, cool. And now I want to run my little Julia quad function. Oh no, first I need to turn those two things into a complex. There must be a clever way to do that, but I don't know what it is, since I don't really use complex numbers very much. So I'm instead just going to go np.empty. if you want them to be doubles, you can make it np.complex128. Oh yeah, I did it the wrong way around. That's the type we want it to be. The size we want is s by s. And then you can go cc.real equals xx, cc.imag equals yy. And then if we print out cc's type and shape, we should find that it's a complex 128 with shape 256 by 256. Yeah. Okay. All right, so now I think we actually have like that map, like just the grid points in this 256 by 256 array. We want to run this Julia quad function on each of those things, right? So you could imagine, let's write it the kind of old-timey way. Let's go, let's make a new array of integers and go just count up the for each of those things, run, put the result in ij of Julia quad of cc ij c like that. Right? So this is just like writing out the loops of going over each point and running that function on each one and plugging the results into this array n. And then the thing is, now we have to actually do something with the results. And so I'm going to now save it as a, save it as an image. So if I can do with matplotlib, so I'm going to import pylab. And also, because I'm going to need it in a minute, I'm going to import OS. Okay. Okay, so the function I'm going to use is called imsave, which takes a image file name and the array you want to save. let's just try that, see if that works. Okay, so it doesn't, my code didn't print anything. But if I list the current directory, you'll see that there's this image julia.png in the current directory. Now, this is kind of an awkward point because that's on symmetry and I can't easily look at it right now. So there are a couple of options. One is, you know, start up a new shell and use SCP to copy it to your own computer and then open it. Here's another one. okay, so if you make dir minus p squiggle slash public underscore html and then copy that julia.png file to there, then you can go over to your favorite web browser and go to symmetry one, squiggle your username, and you should get a directory listing. This should actually work for all of you if you have accounts on symmetry. And there's the image we just made.
Beautiful.
I know, isn't it? So I know it was kind of a, it was a little tedious getting to that point, but there, that's what we just made. It's awesome. So Julia says they're great. okay, but the way that code was written, so maybe I'll just pause for a second and like people can try to.
Can you show the code?
Yeah, oh yeah, sure. Right, so here, let me. So I did make dir minus p squiggle slash public underscore html. And then I did copy that to there. The other thing you
can you also show the code, maybe scroll a bit?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, this. Let's see. Can't quite fit it here. I have to delete a bit of stuff to fit it all on the right page. We don't need the Z anymore. We don't need that. It's there. How's that look?
It's nicely
there, that's okay. Okay, I forgot. There's one more thing you have to do for public HTML to work, which is to chmod your home directory. Kind of ugly. 711 squiggle, which just says other people are allowed to look in or like list your home directory. So, because in this case the web server is actually another person, as far as the computers are concerned. So, if you actually want the web browser to be able to view things in public HTML, then it has to be able to look in your directory. Okay. Just going to pause for a second. Let people ask questions or raise hands or whatever about that.
Explain what
a
people mesh grid is.
Yeah, so actually here I should move this one. So mesh grid. What can I say? It basically it takes two arrays and kind of I guess it
tensor product.
It copies, so it probably like transposes one and then broadcasts them effectively. So if you basically what you end up with is one array that has XX is going to have all of the values in XVals copied as many times as the length of YVals. So it's going to have like copies of that along the rows. And then the YY is going to have all of the values in YVals as many times as the length of XVals going down across the columns. So yeah, if I go, let's see. If I go IPython. Port numpy is np, np.meshgrid123456. You'll get back, let's go. Yeah, so see, right? So this one, it has, the first one has copies of that along the rows. Sorry, I should make them different sizes because then it's more clear. Right, so the result, you know, so they both end up the same shape, and this one has these values repeated as many times as that along the columns, and that one has these values repeated along the rows. Okay, so it's good for making like grids of things if you need to like evaluate a function on a grid. Let me move on to the actual like parallel processing part. This bit of writing out the loop and running this on each thing is kind of not very Pythonic, right? Like it's not really the Python style to like write for loops over things. Instead, you usually like to see like list comprehensions or things like that. So here's how, this might not look like nicer to you, but here's how probably most Python programmers would write this.
So you want to explicitly check until everybody has the image?
Oh yeah, okay.
Go ahead.
I don't know. I did
pop. This website that you.
Oh yeah, okay, sure. Yeah, so the URL should be, so I think symmetry works. And then squiggle. So if you go, let's see, it's HTTP. symmetry/squiggle your username. If you do that, you should get a directory listing.
And so, and I'm getting errors. That's through the chmod.
Yeah, right.
What was the value for that?
So it's chmod 711 squiggle.
It's basically set square.
Maybe here I can have a look. Okay. Yeah.
Correct.
And then. Okay. So it's still permission. So I wonder.
I'm currently not in the home.
My
points are.
Dustin might be using a different Python version. And in yours, it might not be.
So it's never doing this because I'm.
That doesn't work.
Okay. So
this is like the apps. So I'm just doing z squared plus some constant.
All right. So apparently, we also have to go chmod 755 squiggle / public HTML. So that
web
browser can actually list in that directory as well.
Which is some random number.
Sorry. Okay, I'm just going to wait for Eric for a second and then I'll carry on. Okay. All right. I'm gonna move on. Okay. So first, I'm gonna start off by rewriting this loop in a kind of more Pythonic way. So there is this function called I'm just remembering there's like, okay, it's fine. It's annoying, but we'll deal with it. So there's this function called map, where you give it a function and a list of things, like a list of arguments, and it runs that function on each of the list of arguments and gives you back a list of results. So let me demo that for a second. So let's define, I don't know, let's a function that takes the square of something. So we'll return x squared. Now we can go map that function onto the list 1, 5, 8.
You need to
And it just returns a map object that doesn't make any sense. So if we run a list on that, we'll actually run it and you get the list of results, you know, the square of the first thing, the square of the second thing, the square of the third thing, right? So that sort of seems like just what we need here to run, because we want to run like Julia quad on every element in that C array. Actually, just one second. I want to read about map. So there's one thing that's kind of, so what we'd like to do is go map Julia quad CC. Right. But the problem is going to be, that our Julia quad function takes two arguments, right? It takes a z and a c, and map only passes it one thing. So, so basically that didn't work. We need to, so here's a thing that like often comes up in writing this sort of code. You end up having to write like basically a thin little wrapper that sort of takes the arguments you have and like calls the function you want to call. So I'm going to write basically like a little shim or a little like adapter function. I'm going to call it Julia 2 because I'm super creative. It's going to take one argument and it's going to call Julia quad with that argument and C. Right? And then instead of this, we're going to call that one. We're going to call that guy with CC. I'm going to run that, and then we'll talk about it for a second. No, that didn't work. Okay. Yep, I think I know what happened, but let's, I'm going to show you how I might, if I encountered this, how I might figure that out. So there's this little module called PDB for Python Debugger. And if you run it like so, I think this will do what we want. And the commands are a little, the command language for PDB is a little bit complicated, but continue. Like, so it lets you step through your code one line at a time if you so choose. And continue just says keep running until you hit an error. And now it's run and hit that same error and complained about it. And now I'm going to just like look at what you can do L for where are you in the code. And then you can actually like just poke at variables and see what values things have. And it's often a, a useful way of figuring out what went wrong in your code. Okay, so remember that at this point we were expecting Z to be a scalar complex value, right? So, but unfortunately here, Z has become a NumPy array. And its shape is 256. So I think what's happened is, see in my map, I gave it that whole CC, which was a 2D array. So I think it's called that on rows of my 2D array. Said, oh, I know how to iterate through a 2D array. You go through the rows. So instead, we want it to go through each element in turn, right? So there is a way to do that, which is you can go cc.ravel, which is like, I feel like it should be called unravel because it's sort of like unraveling it. It's like a sweater, you know, it's like a 2D array, like a sweater, and then you like unravel it into a 1D array of yarn, but it's called ravel. I don't know why. Raveling seems like you would like turning yarn into a sweater, which seems like is like turning like a 1D thing into a 2D thing. So I don't get it.
That's the review.
Yep.
The Python version here is the one. Oh, you locked it like that. Okay. So I'll figure it out. Yes.
Okay.
Sorry.
Oh yeah. So there.
Differently.
There is.
You do Jupyter Hub, and then you get the wrong Python version, and then you can't install content. Log in via SSH.
Yeah, so there's some funny things about Python versions too. Depending on which version you do, you'll get a different default color map for the image. Okay, anyway, so with that ravel, I don't need PDB anymore. I'm just going to run it because I'm so confident that it's just going to work. Okay, so if we do it with ravel, then it actually does the right, like it does it one element at a time. And runs, and so this whole map thing works. And what I've just printed out this R, so this is just like a printing out of that image we were looking at. It has ones and twos, and we'll have some other values up higher. Okay, so now the only thing is, that thing is kind of the wrong, it's again, the wrong shape. Because we unraveled it, ran the thing on each element and got back a list. So now we have this list and we need to turn it back into a 2D image. This is like one of, these are things that happen, right? Okay, so we can deal with that. We can go, okay, so it's a plain old list. We want to turn it back into a NumPy array and then reshape it back to the shape of C. Okay. So now we should find that R is going to be 256 by 256. It has integers in it. Okay, so finally, we did all of that. And now I promise we're much closer to actually running some parallel code. So I'm gonna remove this so I or comment out that old-timey version. And we should actually still save our results. I should save it and look at it and see if saving as an int still works. So I'm going to copy that to public HTML and hit reload. Ha, it changed color map because I changed Python versions. You can change the color. Oh yeah, here, let's have some fun. So in the msave, you can go cmap for color map equals different ones like hot. Whoops. I'm going to rerun that code, copy the result, and hit reload. Ha, now it's like a fiery Julia set.
Dark matter color scheme?
Something like that. If you play around with that, okay, let me tell you something else. Okay, so in this, But I need my hockey stick. I need to page up a little bit. Right, there we go. Okay. So we had to do this. We had to write this little shim, or this little like adapter function, right, called Julia 2. That it takes a variable x and then calls Julia quad with x and c. Where does c come from? Right? It comes from the surrounding, like from the surrounding environment. It comes from there. It comes from that global that we defined. So it's a little bit like it's a little bit risky. So here's a question. What?
I have a question.
Yeah.
So I mean, it seems a bit dodgy that if you do it this way, it does take C as, you know, globally defined, and then it works. But if you were just to run the map on Julia quad, it can't learn that C is the global variable.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's. Pardon?
You can specify just writing the definition, say C is the global function.
Yeah, that's so. Yeah, like we could have written, you know, we could have written Julia quad differently. So, for example, we could have given a default value for C, or we could have just like you said, defined, you know, defined C up above and just like assumed it as a global variable, or even just stuck C like right in Julia quad and hard coded it. But, you know, often in real life, you know, you have a function like this from one of your collaborators and, you know, it's, and you want to, you know, vary one thing. Or, you know, in, on the next line, you want to make a, or you actually want to make a movie of sweeping through different values of C, which is very, it, check out the Wikipedia page for Julia sets. There's some movies about it. It's beautiful. Forgot how much I like Julia sets. Okay, so that's the end of that digression. This is sort of all digressions. Okay, so these, like, believe it or not, these simple looking four lines turned into these like horrible looking two lines. But most Python programmers would consider these like more stylish, like better. It's not necessarily an aesthetic that always makes sense. But so now we're in a position to start doing some parallel code. So the nice thing is that we wrote this. This map function is a really, really good thing to try to do in parallel, right? Because what map promises to do is you give it a function and a list of things. It runs your function on that whole list of things and returns you a list of the results, right? Do you care if it, like, you can do that in parallel if you wanted to. So there's a function or a module that provides that capability, basically a parallel version of map. So the way we, that's called multiprocessing. So import multiprocessing. And the way to use it is, or at least the way I like to use it, there are kind of different styles, but is to create what's called a multiprocessing pool. Dot pool. And you say how many cores you want to use. So I'm going to go 4 because that's kind of fun. And then basically here, instead of map, we can go pool.map. And does the same thing, except it runs it, it sends it to this processing pool that runs on 4 cores. And actually, there's another plus, which is it returns a list already, so we don't have to cast it, like convert it to a list. So let's run that just for kicks and check that the results actually still look right. Hey. That's my favorite kind of like debugging. It's like where you write something and then hit reload and like, did it explode or does it look the same still? You can try changing C as well just for kicks. Okay, so that, let's actually measure whether that was faster, because that's always like a good thing to check. So for that, can import time. And there are probably better ways of doing this particular step, but here's the one I do. Measure T0, measure T1, and print out map took T1 minus T0 seconds. And then I'm going to do this parallel map took that and go copy that T0 and copy the T1. And let's see how that looks. Cool, right? So map took 2 seconds, parallel map took 0.6 seconds. That's great, right? So that, you know, it actually ran in parallel on multiple cores.
How do you choose?
You can burst into applause now. I pulled it out of the air. I wanted it to be more than one, but fewer than the, I'm running on the head node right now, so I don't want to use like, so using 40 to 80 would be like maxing out the machine. You can, I think you can use.
If you use 40, then you'd be using 800.
Right, and I think you can probably type in 100 and it'll try to do it on 100 processes, but it won't make it any faster because then they're just fighting with each other. Right, so now, yeah, let's see. Okay, so there's a couple, let's actually answer your question in a little bit of a more quantitative way, which is, let's ask what's the right number to set that to? Let's see, how are we for time? We're good. So I'm going to go like this. I'm going to go for, let's see. I'm going to just sweep through increasing the number of CPUs and see how long it takes to run for, in each case. Just for kicks, why not? So I'm going to make go n CPUs from 1 to 20, let's say. Create a new processing pool for each one. Count how long it takes. Oops. T1 minus T0. Okay, and then I'm gonna go plot n CPUs, plot times. Give it a label.
Can you make it a semi log log?
Yeah, good idea. I'll make it log log actually. And let's see. Can I save it directly into public HTML? Time, or does that not work? I don't know, let's find out. np.range doesn't exist. We can do range. And ooh, I'm even gonna do a nice format. Spell. NCPU, where did I? Oh, there we go. NCPUs. slightly faster each time.
Wow. I'm looking at jobs. Someone's using 50 cores here.
It's probably someone, it's probably a joker in the room.
No, it was you.
Is it me? How did that happen?
I see your code, but that thing went up to, I mean, the whole screen was full.
Huh. That's interesting. Oh, and then my plot didn't work. Okay. Oh, right, because I have a typo here and it's supposed to be times. Yeah. Running a little long computation and then crashing on the last line is a way of life. Ah, okay, apparently you can't say, apparently the squiggle doesn't work in Python, so I would have to actually copy my path, so I'd have to go, I can go slash home slash d line there.
Now I want to see the figure actually. Can you skip the next bugs?
Yeah. Can I skip the next bugs? As though I'm doing the bugs on purpose. Can you skip the next bug? Listen, if I could just skip the next bug, I wouldn't be here. okay, so let's go back to there. Haha. Okay, so this is the... Oh, I should have gone a little further. So this is the number of cores increasing and the amount of time it took in seconds to finish. I should have gone up to 40. It turns out I'm gonna use my prerogative of the cooking show of like, here's one I prepared earlier where I did go up to 40. And you can see that, you know, the first couple, it indeed like sort of have, like, it, you know, it's going down pretty sharply. It's like, it's not actually not quite halving, I think, but it's, yeah, looking pretty good. Like, we're actually using all the cores to the max. And then it sort of hits this bottom where it actually doesn't get any faster. Any thoughts on why that might be?
What is the meaning of plot.clf?
Oh, plot.clf is a clear figure. So it clears whatever else. If you had made a previous plot, it clears anything that's on the plot screen. so basically, I'll tell you a little bit about how the Python multiprocessing module works, and that will maybe explain why we hit this floor. So basically the way the multiprocessing or the pool class works is it starts up a bunch of new copies of Python in separate processes and opens pipes to them. So basically it can send them messages and get results. It's like basically the same way as if you start a Python process on the command line, and you can, you know, run commands and get results. The multiprocessing module basically does that, and it starts up a bunch of new Python processes and then can talk to them. The first thing it does is tells them to load the file that you're currently reading and import everything in it. That way it knows about the same functions and the same, like all of the same things are defined in that environment. And then remember it's got this it's running this map where it has this function and the list of things that it wants to run. So basically what it does is says, it sends a bunch of messages that are like Julia 2 and the first element. And it's like, to the first process, your job is to run Julia 2 on the first element, send. And then to the second one, your job is to run Julia 2 on the second element, and it sends that message. And so on, round robining to all of the, say it's got 10 processes, firing one object to each of them, and then waits for replies back. And if they take, if the thing it's computing takes a long time, then you know it might be waiting for a while for until it actually gets a reply, and then it can give that worker the next piece of work. And just does that, working its way round robining through the whole list of tasks to do. Now, that sending the message actually takes some time because it has to encode it and you know send it across the pipe and stuff. So there's a little bit of overhead. And if the amount of computation you're doing on the other end is small enough, then it basically takes more time to send the work and get the result than it actually does to do the computation. So that is basically what's happening here, where this floor that we're hitting is more or less how much time it takes to, like, that's when we're starting to get limited by the overhead of actually like firing up processes, telling them what to do and getting the results back and like assembling the results back into a list. And so this comes up all the time in parallel processing, where you're basically trying to control the amount of work you're doing in that in those parallel processes. Like, so if you were, imagine that instead of making a single image, sorry. So the way to get around this basically is to try to give the workers larger chunks of work to do on each call. So that's not really very easy to do in the code that we've written right now. And I mean, basically, what you end up having to do is kind of structure the code so that the amount of work you're asking to do is large enough that you don't hit these limits. So if we were doing, let's see, I don't actually know of a good way of doing that transparently for this case. But if I were, so imagine that you were, instead of making a single image, you were making a movie, right, of sweeping through a bunch of different, these different C values for Julia sets. You might imagine making each of, making the work package be to make one whole image for, and then we'd map those rather than mapping each pixel, right? Because right now we're sending, we're doing, each work packet is a single, computing a single pixel, and that just doesn't take very long to compute. Whereas actually sending that work packet and getting the results takes some time. So this is kind of a like a recurring issue in parallel programming of all kinds, basically coming up with the right, like chunking at the right level. And there's, I don't really have a good, like there, as far as I can tell, there's no real magic other than you know, having in mind that you want to kind of parallelize at a level where you can split your problem into enough chunks that it actually makes sense to run them on hundreds of, or like tens of cores, but actually not so many that there's that the work packets are tiny. And then that's just kind of like intuition or design to kind of hit that right level. It's not a very pleasing answer, I know, but that's why parallel programmers still have jobs. Is that two for 2 minutes? Or yay for still having yay. Jobs?
Yes.
Okay.
Hey, Dustin, so there's
yeah.
a way to gauge when a single processor is gonna cap out on the, you know, speed of things it can do. Or...
Sorry, say again?
Because, I mean, I guess what you're saying is like this computation is too easy for one processor.
Right.
But I mean, there's definitely, you know, if you start adding we give the whole image to one processor, maybe that's enough. But how do you know, you know, maybe you want more pixels in that image? So how, you know, wouldn't there be a way of knowing when the, you know, that processor is like maxing out, or so to speak, like some optimal way of doing it? Like, I don't know, some speed tests or things like that. No.
Yeah, I'm not really sure. So I guess what I'm, okay, so there was, let's see, there's an experiment we can do. So I guess partly, like, I'm not sure exactly what sets this floor. It might be that that's just purely the amount of time it takes to send the work to the workers and get, you know, get something back. I think that might be essentially what it is, because it's, you know, when you're hitting a limit, it means that you're handing out work and they finish before you get back, like before you can feed them more work. So those CPUs are basically sitting idle while they're just waiting for more work packets. And there's, you know, not a really easy way to speed up that process of handing out the work.
So you can look at what the hardware can do. And given the interconnect that we have, you expect a limit in terms of microseconds. So ideally, it would take 10 microseconds or so for two processes to communicate. And here we say, see kind of 100 milliseconds. So there's definitely be a bit of floor. But then it's Python and lists of communicate and so on. So maybe a different language would help. But it's difficult to find out what's going on and how to make it better.
You know, again, that's like not a very pleasing answer. This is like maybe a theme to my lectures, that, like, life is difficult. Okay, so along that line, let's do a cautionary tale. Here's a, I want to ignore that bit of code, so I just went if false and then intended that block. What if we, so let's try to purely count that overhead, right? Let's ask, how long does it take to send work to a worker and do nothing? Like, just purely count the overhead. Let's create a multiprocessing dot pool with, I don't know, 4 cores. And what I'm going to, so I'm going to pool.map do nothing. And I want to, let's see, actually, if we just, what if we just have a list that contains a million copies of the value 0, right? So this is like purely, okay, oh, let's do, first let's do the serial version, and then let's do the parallel version. Other way around. I don't actually know what the result of this is going to be, because I like to live dangerously. Oh yeah, that's right. Still have still computing a Julia setup above. So I think I'll turn that off. Okay. Doing nothing took 0.06 seconds. Parallel doing nothing took 0.09 seconds. Well, that's bad. We made life worse. You know, so actually that, and that was just sending, that was sending the value 0. Now let's make it a little bit more perverse. Instead of sending just a single scalar, let's send something bigger. Right? So I'm going to just make a random array. And it's going to have size, I don't know, 1,000 by 1,000. And now instead of doing nothing, well, I'm still going to do nothing. I'm just going to do nothing with this big array. I'm going to initialize that outside the timer. And then let's also do that in parallel. Okay, so now doing nothing still took 0.06 seconds. Parallel doing nothing took 10 times longer. Let's make this a little bigger. Let's make it 10 times bigger. Doing nothing on that in serial still took 0.06 seconds. Now parallel doing nothing took 4 seconds. Right? So, you know, remember, even though we're doing nothing, that multiprocessing still had to take that big boy and serialize it, like send it over the wire, like basically package it up into a bitstream and send it over the pipe to each of the workers who then do nothing on it, and return a quick result. And that process, like just packaging it up, took that long.
That many times. So
yeah, I mean, you know, we did that we did that a million times. So, you know, it's and I guess the point to make is that in the doing nothing version, that was just running on this local machine, right? So it never had to make a copy of that big array or anything else like that. So that's why that sort of basically remains fast regardless of how big that big boy is. whereas in the parallel version, if you send a lot of stuff over the wire, it takes time. And that that ends up being, that's one of the ways that multiprocessing code can kind of bite you and turn out to be slower than you were hoping, because often in Python, like you can accidentally build up like data structures that end up being bigger than you thought they were going to be, and accidentally sending those over the wire. And it all sort of like works magically, except it takes a long time. Should I do Slurm scripts quickly, or should we quick? Okay.
I have a question about this pool.map.
Yeah.
Does it not work if the function is a lambda? I'm getting an error when I was trying to do that.
Yes, that's right. That's right. It doesn't work. Okay. So let's. I'm going to answer that in a way that. I'm going to answer that in a slow way. Okay. So you might say, writing this silly Julia 2 wrapper, that's really ugly. Python has this built-in thing called lambdas, where you can like write a function like in line without giving it a name, right? So, and that looks like this. So instead of calling Julia 2 here, we would go, let's see, I'm gonna need some help. You go lambda x, and then is it colon?
Yeah.
Julia quad xc, like that?
Yeah.
Right. So that basically just does the same thing, except instead of having to define this new function, this little wrapper function, it's sort of done inline. This lambda basically just like creates a little local function. But the thing is, the way multiprocessing talks to its subprocesses and tells them what function to call, it doesn't send them the code. It literally sends Julia2 is the name of the function you're going to call, right? So that lambda doesn't have a name. So it doesn't have anything to send. Like it doesn't have, you know. So basically the rule is basically it has to be a name that is important. It's actually a little bit complicated. Like you nested functions and other things like that aren't in the global namespace also, I think, don't work in that same way because they don't have like a dotted name or whatever. Like they basically have to be like available in the global namespace. Yeah, good. Okay, any further questions, thoughts, worries? Oh, I should say one other thing. The multiprocessing pool does have some different, like map isn't sort of the only way to use it. It has some other capability, like other ways of doing parallel calls. Like a really neat one is actually it has a bunch of things that start with async. Like I have the manual page up. So apply async, where you say, I have a function and an argument, and I want you to go off and like assign that task, and then, but not wait until it finishes, and you get back like an async result thing that you can, then later you can say, wait until that thing is done, or wait for the value from this thing. So you could, instead of, you know, in map, we're basically letting the multiprocessing module hand out the work. With things like apply async, you can sort of do that yourself if you want to kind of take control over which things are being called. Like if you want to call, instead of calling a single function on a bunch of things, if you wanted to do like a bunch of different functions with different arguments and have those run in parallel on different cores, then you can do that with async maps. Async applies where you know, sort of store like do a bunch of async applies on different values and then wait for all the results at the end. Yes. But didn't get to that today. And, oh yeah, okay, so another thing is it is also possible to run something like a multiprocessing pool across many machines. Which I actually haven't really done, so I can't tell you about it. Because basically it already has this concept of like having a pipe where you send the work to be done, get the results. That also works pretty well on a collection of machines. Although you hit the problem of having to hand out the work and make sure that the amount of work being done on each machine is big enough, sort of that problem gets larger. Okay, I'm gonna wrap up. Unless there are any further. Okay, well, thank you kindly for your attention. Bye-bye.